Today on The World, Hong Kong is doing what President Trump would like to do, postponing elections. And the numbers are in, and Europe's economy is reeling. The silver lining? There's nowhere to go but up.
Going from zero to something is already quite a positive result.
In the Bahamas, bracing for a hurricane during a pandemic. What is that like?
It's just chaos. It's just what you would expect.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today on the show, pulling a Japanese version of cumbia out of the crate for Latin dance parties.
It's my secret stealth weapon. If I'm doing a tropical night somewhere of vinyl, all of a sudden hear somebody singing in Japanese.
Those stories and much more today, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here this Friday. Holding a democratic election during a global pandemic. How do you make sure it's safe, free, and fair? That's a puzzle officials are wrestling with in a number of countries, including here in the U.S. Yesterday, President Trump tweeted that U.S. elections should be postponed, an idea that was quickly dismissed, even by leaders in the Republican Party. In an authoritarian one-party state, it's easier to delay an election. In Hong Kong, that's what they decided today. The legislative election scheduled for September has been postponed by a year. Here's The World's Matthew Bell with more.
The announcement came from Carrie Lam, the highest-ranking official in Hong Kong.
Since January this year, we have been fighting the virus together for 7 months.
Speaking through a white face mask, Lam said postponing the legislative election was the hardest decision she's had to make.
But then we want to ensure fairness, we want to ensure public safety and health, and also we need to make sure that the elections are held in an open, fair, and impartial manner. So this decision is therefore essential.
Lam went on to say that this has nothing to do with politics and nothing to do with the likely outcome of the election. But there have been signs that Beijing and its supporters in Hong Kong have plenty to worry about politically.
They are very fearful of losing control over the Legislative Council.
Victoria Hoi is a professor of political science at the University of Notre Dame. She's also from Hong Kong. Hoi says Beijing has taken a series of recent steps to quash democracy in the Chinese territory.
Because only a day ago, the authorities also disqualified 12 pro-democracy candidates from running at all.
A few days before that, four young Hong Kong activists, some of them teenagers, were arrested for expressing views online that China doesn't like. Hoi says it's almost puzzling what Beijing is doing.
Any one of these moves would have been enough to make sure that Beijing can control the legislature. Why would they have to double down? Just making sure, essentially, just to completely stifle the will of the people of Hong Kong.
Hong Kong's electoral system has always been tilted heavily in favor of pro-Beijing candidates. But still, when pro-democratic political parties recently held a primary, Hoi says there was a massive turnout despite warnings from the Chinese government.
So there's a lot of popular support for the pro-democracy candidates. And also, in November last year, in the district council elections, the district councils don't really do much other than, you know, setting up building bridges and setting up bus stops and clearing garbage and stuff. But still, there was an overwhelming support and pro-democracy voices. They won the landslide. Beijing is very worried that this could happen again.
Postponing the election for a year gives the Chinese government more time to disqualify more opposition candidates, says Casey Wong. He's a visual artist and a university teacher in Hong Kong. Wong says it's also about using a harsh new security law to prosecute those who dare to publicly defy the will of Beijing.
What's going on in between these next 12 months would be a lot of prosecutions.
Wong says Hong Kong's experience offers a lesson for other countries.
For example, using the pandemic as an excuse to delay the election. This can happen in America too, or in any country. So don't let it happen.
That said, he points to Singapore and South Korea as examples of two countries that faced the challenge of holding a democratic election during the coronavirus pandemic. And both of them, Wong says, pulled it off successfully. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Today, U.S. health leaders were back in the hot seat on Capitol Hill, testifying before a House panel about the pandemic. Questions focused on getting schools open again and the possibility of a vaccine on the horizon. Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was asked about that vaccine timeline.
We hope that as the time we get into the late fall and early winter, we will have, in fact, a vaccine that we can say would be safe and effective. One can never guarantee the safety or effectiveness unless you do the trial, but we are cautiously optimistic that this will be successful.
Dr. Fauci was also asked why Europe has been doing a better job at containing the spread of this virus.
If you look at what happened in Europe when they shut down or locked down or went to shelter in place, however you want to describe it, they really did it to the tune of about 95%+ of the country did that. When you actually look at what we did, even though we shut down, even though it created a great deal of difficulty, we really functionally shut down only about 50% in the sense of the totality of the country.
But the near total shutdown in Europe came with a heavy economic cost. The pandemic has sent the Eurozone into a historic recession. GDP across the European Union economies is down more than 12%. That's about 3% worse than the U.S. Some European countries like Spain and Portugal fared even worse than the average. The World's Orla Barry joins us from London. These figures are not good, Orla. Were they expected to be this bad?
Yes, some economists were saying today the figures are dreadful, but not unexpected. You have to remember, in a sense, Marco, while right now a lot of the focus on the rate of the virus infections is in the US and Brazil and India, there was a time, you'll remember, back in March when all we were talking about was Italy and Spain. And in effect, this is what the figures are telling us today. Spain and Italy both had really bad infection rates and really bad fatality rates, and Spain's GDP dropped by 18% in just 3 months, which was, by the way, way worse than was expected.
What is behind that figure? Is a large portion about a drop in tourism?
Actually, it's not all about tourism. What it is, in a sense, is reflective also of the severity of the lockdown. So Spain's lockdown, if you remember, was particularly harsh and particularly long. So in Spain, I mean, many of us remember those stories about the children not being allowed out of the house for months on end. If you look at France, for example, the lockdown there was also considerably strict. You had to have a note to leave the house. And in France's case, GDP has also dropped considerably. So that's kind of part of the story. Another thing to bear in mind is that some of these countries are already going through the ringer effectively economically. Spain and Italy, their economies weren't doing great. And Italy now is heading into its fourth recession since 2008. So the coronavirus pandemic was really the last thing that Italy needed.
Yeah, some real economic pain. What about the third quarter then, heading into the fall? Is that expected to look any better?
Well, the hope is that it will, or as some would say, could it get any worse? But things are pretty precarious. France yesterday, for example, recorded a 54% increase in coronavirus cases in just 1 week. And then Poland recorded its highest number of cases ever yesterday. So we're seeing the real impact of the second wave, as we've been talking about. But I did talk to Bert Corline, who's a senior Eurozone economist with the financial institution ING, about this earlier, and he was a little more optimistic.
You're going to get almost an automatic large bounce back in the third quarter because of the fact that stores have gone from being completely shut down, factories completely shut down, to starting production again. Now, if you look at that on a quarterly basis, going from zero to something is already quite a positive result. But keep in mind that in Spain, we've already seen reopenings of the economy being reversed at a local level because of new localized outbreaks of the virus, which means that, of course, you can expect that the third quarter will even be somewhat more pessimistic because of that.
Just a week ago, Orla, we heard about the huge EU recovery fund that was agreed to help EU countries deal with the economic fallout from the pandemic. A fund of 750 billion euros, that's about $885 billion. How will that help? Who's on the receiving end?
Well, here's the difficulty with the fund, Marco, because the money actually doesn't start to be distributed until early next year. So that's relatively late in terms of assisting countries that are in the doldrums right now. But there is a positive side to this, as Bert Corline explained to me earlier.
there is already some benefit that we get from the fact that the recovery fund has been announced, because it does bring a lot of confidence to financial markets. So the message that the EU sends brings trust with it that no country will be left behind. And that is definitely helpful, even though the ECB is already suppressing interest rates quite significantly at the moment.
Yeah, tough times. The world's Orla Barry in London. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
The economic pain isn't just in Europe. In Africa, food prices are up, crop yields are down, tourism is virtually dead. For the next few minutes, we're going to hear how the downturn has affected migrant workers in South Africa. John McDermott, the Africa correspondent for The Economist, takes us there.
In South Africa, there are millions of migrants from other parts of Africa. Most of these people work in low-paying jobs. They live hand-to-mouth, whether as domestic workers, construction workers, or in the hospitality sector. And naturally, the response to the pandemic has been very hard on them. A few weeks ago, I went down to Hillbrow in Johannesburg, where I met a domestic worker from Zimbabwe named Nomsa Chishuma, who told me just how difficult it's been to survive a lockdown in the city.
Yeah, we're not working, we're working, everything has stopped.
She told me that her employers, a family from an affluent suburb in Johannesburg, had stopped paying her usual monthly salary.
The first month they gave me the normal pay, but now they just sometimes give 200, 300, and we're paying rent where we stay. Not easy.
And when that happens, and she doesn't have a proper income, how is she supposed to pay her bills? And Nomsa's far from alone in South Africa. People who work in these low-paid jobs are now going for months without pay, and those that have gone back to work are doing so with fewer hours. When I was in Hillbrow, I spoke to Bongani Mkwananzi from the Zimbabwean community of South Africa, and he told me that there were implications beyond South Africa's borders, because a lot of Zimbabweans are the main breadwinners for their families back home.
The people that they normally take care of at home are now stranded. And, it feels like hopeless, like there's no recourse really.
The South African government has announced various measures in response to the pandemic. But in the main, there's been one set of rules for South Africans and another set of rules for migrants. This is true whether we're talking about cash grants to help people get by, or whether we're talking about which businesses are targeted for closure. So migrant-run shops in townships, for example, have been disproportionately shut down by the government's pandemic regulations. When I was in Hillbrow, I witnessed an organization called the African Diaspora Forum handing out food parcels to migrants living in South Africa. One of its leaders, a Somali man called Amir Sheikh, told me that migrants are destitute and excluded from government help, so therefore many are simply relying on charity.
That's John McDermott in South Africa. His story comes to us from the Intelligence podcast from Economist Radio. The Intelligence also includes a follow-up conversation on migration with Robert Guest, foreign editor of the magazine. The question they're asking, once the pandemic is over, will the world become more or less restrictive for migrants?
Overall, I fear that the world is going to become more restrictive because of the pandemic. But there's a chance it won't. And one reason for thinking that is that some of the nationalist populist leaders who are most opposed to immigration have been shown to be incredibly incompetent in dealing with COVID-19.
To hear more from Robert Guest on migration, check out the Intelligence podcast wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. You may recall reports of a cluster of coronavirus infections that was traced to a choir rehearsal back in the spring. More than 50 members of this choir, the Skagit County Chorale in Mount Vernon, Washington, were infected in what the CDC called a super spreader event. Two people died. It was the first account, but not the last, linking community transmission of the coronavirus with singing. But while most experts agree that singing in a group is risky, no studies have measured that risk scientifically up to now. Jonathan Reed is leading a research team at Bristol University in the UK looking into virus transmission and singing. Professor, first of all, many of us may not imagine singing to be a lethal activity. So how serious is this?
It's very difficult to answer that question at the moment. The studies just have not been done, and that's really where our study comes in. Mm. So far, studies have focused on, for example, on speaking and looking at how the number of particles, how they increase as you speak louder. But we just don't know the answer to that for singing yet, and that's really what we're trying to assess in this study.
So what have you been measuring, and how have you been doing it?
So we've had to do these measurements in an orthopedic operating theater, which has very, very clean air. So we can be certain that every particle we measure actually comes from the performer, whether they're singing or speaking.
Start singing in 10 seconds. So we've got a recording of one of your test subjects.
4, 3, 2, 1. Happy birthday to you.
So, Professor, I see in the video that the singing is done through a funnel. Why is that?
The funnel is the way we sample the aerosol from someone singing into the very sensitive instruments that we have to count the number of particles that they're generating.
Wow. So somebody's got a really good singing voice. That woman singing Happy Birthday, why pick that song for this test?
We've picked that song just because it can be recited by singers and by instrumentalists. And for singers, it has a range of consonants and vowels. You know, it provides a very good comparison across our large cohort of participants.
How big a study is this? And how do you select your subjects? I mean, like I said, she sounded pretty talented.
She was actually a very good amateur. Ah. So we have participants from across a broad range of genres, from opera through to soul, gospel, jazz, pop. And in terms of instruments, woodwind and brass, we studied 12 instruments from flute, piccolo, bassoon through to trumpet, trombone, and tuba.
So the case I mentioned in the introduction, the chorale in Washington State, 61 people there, more than 50 got sick. Apparently, a lot of people attending were aware of what they had to do to stay safe. So how does singing compare with other activities in which people congregate, even when those people are conscious of best health practices?
When we're concerned with airborne transmission, physical distancing doesn't really help. It's really about how well ventilated a room is, because these aerosol particles can remain airborne for many minutes or hours. And so really they travel distances more than the 1 to 2 meters that we're all accustomed to in physical distancing.
Have you ever sung in a choir, Professor?
I sing a great deal. I usually sing a great deal, and I also play the trumpet. So I'm very much keen to really get to the results of this study as soon as we can as well. You know, like many amateur performers, I am missing that opportunity to participate in music.
Jonathan Reed is a professor of chemistry at Bristol University in the UK. Thank you very much for telling us about this study.
Thank you.
Transportation across the globe, trains, planes, cars, and buses, it's all slowed down to a trickle during the pandemic. Uganda's normally busy capital, Kampala, has been eerily quiet under one of the strictest lockdowns in Africa. Now Uganda is reopening. And as the world's Halima Gikandi reports, one group of drivers is breathing a huge sigh of relief.
Asaf Mugisha never set out to drive bodabodas. Those are essentially motorcycle taxis that Ugandans use all the time. In Kampala, there often seem to be more bodabodas than cars on the streets. And Mugisha says he made a decent living driving one. Then COVID-19 happened.
The bodabodas, we are suspended. It was 25th March. So we have been in lockdown almost like full 4 months.
Uganda imposed a strict lockdown on public transportation, and bodabodas were banned from the streets, meaning thousands of drivers were suddenly out of work. Earlier this month, a group of bodaboda drivers sued the government over the ban. Mugisha says he feels lucky. At least he had some savings, but he and his family had to go on a tight budget. He has a wife and 2 kids.
We didn't have money to buy food for the breakfast and lunch plus supper. So we budget the money that I had so that we can eat once in a day.
But this week has brought some relief to Boda drivers like Mugisha. On Monday, they were allowed to resume taking passengers, which means after 4 months of no work, drivers like Mugisha are finally back on the road. These days, things are looking different for drivers and passengers.
So I put my face mask and helmet. Before I start my trip, I have to first sanitize my customer.
He gives hand sanitizer to customers before and after each trip. But with many stores closed, there aren't as many customers. Before COVID, Mugisha could earn about $19 on a good day. This week, he's been earning less than $5 a day. Things have changed in other ways, too. The government now requires Boda drivers to record the names and numbers of their passengers. Information Minister Judith Nabakuba explained why during a recent press conference.
These details will help in following up should any of the contacts test for COVID-19.
But what if customers don't want to give out their information to strangers? Apollo Mugasa, another Boda Boda driver in Kampala, says that's been a big problem this week.
They're saying they want to keep their privacy with their telephone numbers. But my personal customers, they have no problem with that. But the customer you get on the way, most of them, they don't.
I called up an old friend of mine to ask what he thought about the privacy concerns. Ibrahim Anun is a software developer in Kampala. He recently created a new Boda ride-hailing app called Good Boda. It's like Uber for Bodas. It's one of the many ride-hailing apps in Uganda these days. He says getting people to register with these apps could be a solution to both privacy and contact tracing concerns.
Because the client has already registered with the app and the rider has also already registered with the app. So all they have to do is just link up, and of course there'll be information in the system of the trip and who did the trip and all that. So tracking that is easier.
In fact, the Ugandan government is now encouraging Boda Boda drivers to register with ride-hailing apps. But drivers like Apollo Mugasa still have the reservations. He used to use a ride-hailing app, but stopped. He says the tech companies are taking too big of a cut.
They charge you a helmet, they charge you a phone, they charge you. There's nothing they can give, but again, they charge you 15% or per trip you take.
Boda Boda drivers and even regular taxi drivers have protested ride-hailing apps over high fees and low wages in the past. But now, with more options to choose from, Mugasa says he hopes to get a better deal. Overall, he says the changes will help the industry become more organized. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
You're listening to The World. Sports are coming back, so are the fans. Not physically there.
Replicating the atmosphere of the fans behind closed door match is hard.
How sports broadcasters get the virtual bleachers going during a pandemic. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH and PRX. In the Atlantic Ocean today, Hurricane Isaias has been lashing out at the southeastern Bahamas and the Turks and Caicos Islands, headed toward Florida. Battling strong winds and heavy squalls is being made even more difficult in a time of pandemic. It's simply not easy to stockpile supplies and social distance at shelters, nor is the race to rescue people. Eddie Wan heads the Bahamas Air and Sea Rescue Association, or BASRA, in Grand Bahama. We caught up with him in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. What is happening on the ground in the Bahamas, Eddie? It sounds as though volunteers and others are going door to door, getting people out from low-lying areas.
Yes, Marco. Yes, we as BASRA have been visiting low-lying areas. We're trying to get some food and water and the like to hold them over for a few days. We're expecting this to hit Grand Bahama tomorrow night or Sunday morning, early 2 o'clock in the morning. We're doing our best to prepare. Once again, move any person in any low-lying area to either a shelter or higher ground to other family members or friends.
And what is the expectation for Grand Bahama when the storm hits?
So far right now, total chaos, obviously, bearing in mind that just some 10 months ago, Dorian pounded us, and 2.5 years before that, Matthew pounded us, each one of them being a Cat 5. This one is going to hit us as a Cat 2. So it's, you know, well, yeah, no big deal. Well, no, that's not our attitude. And then during that, we're in a COVID lockdown in Grand Bahama right now, in that a week ago, the prime minister put the island on a 2-week, 14-day, 24-hour lockdown due to the second surge of COVID that was rampant quite heavily in Grand Bahama.
Yes,
so he's opened the hardware stores, the pharmacies, the food stores and the like yesterday to start preparing for this storm that's headed our way.
Specifically, how has a pandemic complicated rescue missions? Presumably you're wearing masks and gloves when you're doing the operation.
Yes, Marco. Yeah. The PPE is really important. We're trying to follow the rules to the letter. It's just a second wave hit, and there's not a whole bunch anybody can do about it other than pray to our good Lord, because we are a Christian nation. And, of course, follow the rules, you know, the social distancing, the masks, the washing of the hands. And more importantly, right now, staying your butts at home.
Mm. But I think about stockpiling supplies, people seeking shelter where you're crowded. I mean, talk about that. What solutions are you able to come up with?
Well, the food store lines, for one, they stretch around the block right now. Oh, my gosh. The hardware store, the lines, they easily stretch for a couple hundred yards. It's just chaos. Everybody is just in total panic and total chaos.
And where will they go for shelter?
We have a couple of schools, some church auditoriums that are on high ground. In the unlikely but unfortunate, if we have another storm surge, that they will be high enough and they will be safe.
Mm. What are you hearing about how Bahamians are holding up just emotionally? I mean, you said that the country's barely gotten over Hurricane Dorian. A Cat 5 hurricane devastated the region last September. What have you heard?
It's total panic. I've spoken with my office. I have three offices in Freeport. Everybody's there. We're closed. Just the hardware stores, the pharmacies. We're open in our retail store for the cleaning chemicals and bleaches and whatever, you know, you might need immediately following the departure of the storm. I just don't know what to say apart from describe it as just total panic right now.
Eddie Juan heads the Bahamas Air and Sea Rescue Association, BASRA. He's helping prepare for Hurricane Isaias. Eddie, good luck. We're thinking of you, hoping for a weakening of the storm.
Thank you, Marco. I appreciate your time, sir.
It's been about a month now since Washington's football team scrapped their name. The decision seems to have caught on, with sports teams in Cleveland and Edmonton, Canada, dropping or considering changing their racially insensitive names. But England's leading rugby team is defying that trend. The World's Rupa Shenoy explains.
At matches, fans of the Exeter Chiefs rugby team wear headdresses, perform tomahawk chops, and sing this song. This is all encouraged by the team's mascot, Big Chief, who wears a headdress and carries a tomahawk.
He's kind of stumpy, and it looks like a, I don't know, like a cartoon version of a Native American crossed with a leprechaun.
That's Patrick Cox, a longtime editor and contributor to The World and co-host of the podcast Subtitle. He grew up in the 1970s, where the Exeter Chiefs have been based for 150 years, Devon, England.
I didn't even know the rugby club were called the Chiefs. They were never referred to that way. And there was no hoopla. There was no voice coming over the loudspeaker getting people to do the tomahawk chop. There was nothing. There was no association with Native Americans.
That changed in the 1990s when rugby went professional. The club rebranded, taking on the Native American imagery. Now, bars and restaurants near the club stadium, Sandy Park, are named things like the Powwow Bar and the Wigwam Bar. The club's online store is called the Trading Post. All of that is coming under renewed scrutiny now, led by a group of fans called the Exeter Chiefs for Change. Elena Soper is one of its 10 members who are not Indigenous themselves, but are backed by Indigenous groups.
I am not personally offended by what the branding is, but I know that it is racist and it is harmful, and it reflects really badly on rugby as a sport, but also on the current culture in the UK.
They started a petition calling on the club to rebrand. They're okay with keeping the name Chiefs, but suggest tying it to Celtic Chiefs instead. Thousands have signed the petition. Soper says the organizers have been doxxed, threatened, and abused online.
When you confront someone with something that they don't believe to be offensive or wrong, and something that they have treasured very closely in themselves, if you tell them that what they are doing is wrong and that it is racist, people get their backs up immensely.
The Exeter Chiefs haven't spoken publicly on the issue, but fans started a counter petition in support of the branding. They say it's a respectful tribute to Native Americans. Fan Ian Dunstan talked to ITV.
You can't trivialize this, because what may have started off as cultural appropriation has been called out by people, and probably rightly so, because we're more educated now. But the way that I think most of the fans and people are looking at it, it's actually cultural appreciation, which is a very, very different thing.
On Wednesday, the club board met to consider both petitions. They decided not to change the branding, a move that many fans have praised. The Exeter Chiefs for Change group says they'll keep fighting.
It's completely tone deaf. It's really disappointing that they have thrown away this opportunity to show itself as an inclusive club.
But the Exeter Chiefs are making one sacrifice. Their mascot, Big Chief, will be laid to rest. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
You know what really bugs me? Here. A guy walks into a bar. That right there, the fakey sound of canned laughter. These days, though, if you're watching sports, you might not be able to escape canned crowd noise. So where are those cheers and jeers coming from? Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
When German football teams Dortmund and Bayern hit the field for a match in May, the crowd seemingly went wild.
Müller, now Kimmich. Kimmich has gone for a little dainty chip. It's beautiful! Oh, gorgeous chip for Kimmich!
Cheers there for the first goal of the game. Well, I'll put cheers in air quotes. The stands were empty, and the cheers were really just canned applause being pumped out through stadium speakers. It's a bizarre but necessary reality as athletes return to fields, courts, and starting lines while fans stay home. Take a listen to these two clips from Australia's National Rugby League. Here's how the play actually sounded.
Lynch, scrappy old kick, but not a bad one actually. And then Martin, oh, absolutely superb, and Revolt kicks his third.
Just the sounds of players and commentators there. Now, here's what the same play sounded like on TV.
Lynch, scrappy old kick, but not a bad one, actually. And then Martin, oh, absolutely superb, and Revolt kicks his third.
Crowd noise added there from a previous match, which is a different approach from the English Premier League and Spanish La Liga, who are using sounds from the video game FIFA 20, like this crowd singing from the stands. Kinda sounds real. In South Africa, sounding real has been top of mind for broadcasting giant SuperSport.
Replicating the atmosphere of the fans behind closed door match is hard because South Africans have a very unique fan culture.
Deshni Naidu is the head of production operations at SuperSport International. She says their stadium culture isn't just chants and cheers, it's the infamous vuvuzela too. When football begins in South Africa next week, fans at home will be hearing the vuvuzela and other game sounds from previous matches.
We have audio samples for specific scenes, your penalties, your fouls, the ahs and the oohs, how your fans would react.
But generating instant reactions to a live football match isn't easy. Alvin Neiker, head of production content, says there's a game plan for that.
Obviously, you need a very sharp and clued up audio operator. So we decided to have two people, one to control audio for cheering and the other one for disappointment.
Part of the fun of cheering, though, is feeling like you're a part of the action. Now that the logistics of getting teams back on the field are mostly figured out, fan engagement is getting more attention.
The games are just not the same without fans.
Brad Roberts is part of the German-based team behind an app called My Applause, which lets fans control which noises are blasted through stadium speakers. It's pretty simple. You download the app and choose your team's upcoming match. Then it's time for your thumbs to do the talking.
When you download the app, you have four options: cheer, clap, sing, or whistle, the sound of the audience, and this is fans reacting in real time, that gets played through the stadium speakers so the players can hear it. In return, that sound gets picked up by the television cameras and comes back through the television.
Jürgen Kreuz, the campaign manager of My Applause, says they found that fans around the world cheer differently.
For example, in Australia, we received the feedback that they do not boo there so much in the stadium. And then they said, okay, we do not need the boo function there or the whistling function there. We do something else. In England, if you don't have a boo or a whistling, that will be like, okay, the app is not worth anything.
Meaning Brits like to trash talk. Fans have expressed nothing short of desperation for sports to re-enter their lives. Some say bring on the enhanced audio. Others think it's distracting and disingenuous. So broadcasters have largely left it up to viewers to decide by offering one version of a game with artificial crowd noise and one version with a more silent stadium. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
When historians look back on this year, 2020, they'll pore through news coverage, journals, and diaries, and art. In the UK, artists have been creating portraits of frontline healthcare workers as part of an online project called Portraits for NHS Heroes. Joining me now is one artist and her subject. Jane Clatworthy is a painter, and Dr. Georgina Keogh is a doctor at St. George's Hospital. They're both in London. Jane, let me start with you. As an artist, what made you want to take part in the Portraits for NHS Heroes project?
You know, as lockdown started, we were all left floundering and trying to, you know, find meaning and all the rest of it. And the initiative was started by a fellow artist, Tom Croft. We had something on Thursday evenings, a clap for NHS Heroes. And so Tom decided on the back of that, as an artist, he could actually give a little bit of something back. And it's just a real, you know, way of acknowledging frontline workers who were taking on more than their usual duties.
During the height of the pandemic, you couldn't meet in person to do the portrait sittings. You had to exchange reference photos instead. So, Georgina, talk to me about the photos you chose to send to Jane. One, you're in a bathtub holding your head in your hands. There's real vulnerability in your pose. Why'd you choose that image?
I wanted to do one that kind of reflected how I'd been feeling about kind of everything that was going on at work. And I wanted to be a bit more personal. I mean, at work, you're in your scrubs and you're in your mask. I didn't want to be all covered up in a front. I wanted it to be how I felt. So, you know, a way that I relax was kind of having a bath at the end of the day. Not much else we could do during lockdown.
Describe that feeling that was conjured up by that pose, by that gesture.
I guess it's just a release after work. I mean, obviously, it was a completely different time that we were working in, and lots of it was very new, and lots of it was really sad. So I was going to work every day, but I was on my own at home because people that I live with had left London. And obviously, if you're working every day with coronavirus, you know, you don't want to put anyone else at risk.
Sure.
So that was just something that felt honest, I think, maybe.
Jane Clatworthy, when you saw Dr. Keogh's photo, what was your reaction? Did it suggest any immediate emotions that you wanted to carry into your execution of the portrait?
Well, you know, in all honesty, when I received Georgina's images, I actually cried because, you know, we'd met on Zoom and I'd seen this young doctor at the front and having to process quite a lot of grief. You know, we were all at during the height of the pandemic, trying to come to grips with this new normal, and just on a sort of day to day basis, our lives had all been upended. And but as a doctor, having to face a sort of virus that they didn't have the tool sets yet, it was still unknown. They were still discovering, and every day on the news, they announcing the death numbers, and it, you know, there's a lot of trauma there. So I was just really grateful that Georgina was, you know, so authentic and had chosen to share that vulnerability. So I felt, you know, incredibly humbled by that.
Georgina, you recently had the opportunity to visit Jane's studio and see the painting. What was it like?
I felt really humbled. I mean, someone as talented as Jane to take the time to paint my portrait, it just made me feel special, which is actually really nice. And actually, to take something positive out of this whole experience has been just a really nice thing.
Jane, as the artist, what do you hope people take away from seeing this painting? I mean, is the takeaway different from like your pre-pandemic portraits?
There's so many mental health issues at the moment around the pandemic, but just also, you know, around the fact that we're guarded and there's an online world that shows the perfect image of someone. To actually create a portrait that will perhaps give other people the ability to experience their own emotions and to process, you know, it creates that space. And I think other humans always respond to an authentic image that enables them to have that dialogue.
Jane Clatworthy is a figurative artist. Georgina Keogh is a doctor at St. George's Hospital in London. Jane recently completed a portrait of Georgina as part of the online project Portraits for NHS Heroes. That's the National Health Service of the UK. Jane, Georgina, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Marco. Thank you.
For months now, Japan and Hawaii have been in talks about forming a pandemic partnership. A promotional ad there encouraging Japanese tourism to the islands. Japan and Hawaii have a long travel history, so a travel bubble does make sense. Yesterday, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe gave the idea the thumbs up. Hawaii is the only U.S. state to make Japan's safe travel list. It would certainly give a boost to Hawaii's flagging economy. The state's taken a huge hit after tourism and travel came to a grinding halt during the pandemic. So an agreement with Japan is a step in the right direction. As of March, Hawaii had less than 2,000 reported cases of COVID-19. The only state that had fewer was Vermont. Then yesterday, Hawaii's Governor David Ige dropped this announcement.
This is the first time that we've had and seen more than 100 cases here in Hawaii. This is a new record, and we know that over the past week or so, we have seen higher and higher records set.
And the news from Japan, also not good.
Tokyo reports the highest COVID-19 cases in the country. The majority are their young people. It's from nighttime entertainment, and there is a trend of infection within the family.
Singapore's CNA News there reporting on a second wave of the coronavirus in Japan. Japan recorded around 1,500 new infections today. That's the third straight day of record daily increases. I learned this week about the recent passing of Japanese soul singer Mieko Hirota. I got the news courtesy of a Latin music aficionado I know and follow on social media, Pablo Iglesias, a.k.a. DJ Bongo Head. Pablo told me that Mieko Hirota, or Miko as she was known, had a multi-decade career that won her fans around the world.
She also was adept at singing jazz. She even came to the U.S. and sang at the Newport Jazz Festival, backed by Billy Taylor's trio.
Really cool numbers, like this one she put out in 1965 with jazz legend Billy Taylor on piano, a tune Mel Torme made popular 4 years earlier called I'm Coming Home, Baby. Miko gave it her own words, shall we say. Miko Hirota there with some great support from Billy Taylor, dosing up on the popular vocalese style at the time. No words, but a total groove. Pablo, DJ Bongohead, came across her music a few years back because he's a Latin vinyl crate digger, obsessive in a good way. His book, Cocinando, is just a fat collection of old Latin album cover art. Anyway, over the years, DJ Bongohead has followed several Japanese DJs on social media. Latin music has been popular in Japan since the end of World War II, he told me. The U.S. occupation brought the records and the rhythm. The Japanese wanted more.
About the 60s and 70s, a lot of Japanese artists started recording Latin music. So this Japanese DJ had a 45 of this song that Miko did, Cumbia of Love, and I fell in love with it when I heard it.
恋の日を cumbia 胸は踊るよ。
So I talked to the DJ and he helped me find my own copy. So it's my secret stealth weapon. If I'm doing a tropical night somewhere of vinyl, all of a sudden hear somebody singing in Japanese over this loping cumbia beat. And sometimes I'll slow it down to do it in the rebajada style, which is the Mexican sonidero sound system DJ style of taking a 45 and playing it really slow and putting some effects on it, maybe doing some shout outs over it. And people just go nuts. They come up to the decks and they say, "What was that?" You know? Cumbia, moyase koi no hi wo.
Cumbia, mune wa hodoru yo. So that's a 45 that you play at 33 and a third RPM. Miko sounds like a man there. Why do you do that, Pablo?
I think it makes it more mysterious and more funky, and for those of us who are more challenged with dancing to faster tropical music, it makes it easier. There's been a lot of studies as far as the rebajada culture in Mexico and in the United States as well. There's a number of cases with tropical music where people have played around with the speed, and it's usually to do with making the dancers more comfortable and also for the DJs to put their own, I guess you'd say, stamp on it.
Slowing it down, kind of like Jamaican musicians did with ska in the 50s and 60s. Too fast for some people, artists like Bob Marley and Lee Scratch Perry slowed the beat down and ska became reggae. That's what DJ Bongohead is doing here with the Miko track for Ribajada parties he DJs. And Ribajada?
It's an evening where there is communication between people in the dance hall and their far away loved ones, because the DJ will speak over the microphone and talk over the music, birthday requests, etc., you know. With the shout-outs to relatives and family and friends are sent via MP3 to relatives in other countries.
That is wild. A soul singer from Tokyo died this week, but her legacy lives on, slowed down, in digital messages of love from the dance floors of the Americas. There is something poetic and beautiful about that. We're going to sign off today with the other Miko track we heard and hear the late Mieko Horota at normal speed. I'm coming home, baby. It is Friday, and we are out of here. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for making it today. Stay safe. Stay strong. You all have a great weekend. Shuddy, buddy, get it, and do. Way by last and dwell.